In losing that baby, the parents also will have gained something. They will have lost a baby, but they will have gained experience. They will have paid back a little of what they had to pay back. We will agree that while people are on Earth, their outlook, their perceptions, their values, everything, are distorted. This, I repeat, is the world of illusion, the world of false values, and when people return to the greater world of the over-self, then they can see that the hard, senseless lessons and experiences undergone during this sojourn on Earth were not so senseless after all. I looked about me and thought of all the prophecies about me, prophecies of hardship, prophecies of torture, prophecies of sojourns in far and strange lands. I remarked, then a person who makes a prophecy is merely getting in touch with the source of information. If everything is arranged before one comes down to Earth, then it is possible under certain conditions to tap that knowledge?
Yes, that is perfectly correct, said my guide, but do not think that everything is laid out as inevitable. The basic lines are there. We are given certain problems, certain lines to follow, and then we are left to do the best we can. One person can make good and another person can fail. Look at it in this way. Supposing two men are told that they have to go from here to Kalimpong in India. They do not have to follow the same path, but they have to arrive at the same destination if they can. One man will take one route and another man will take another route, depending upon the route which they take, so will their experiences and adventures be affected. That is like life. Our destination is known, but how we get to that destination remains within our own hands. As we were talking, a messenger appeared, and my guide, with a short word of explanation to me, followed the messenger down the corridor. I wandered again to the window, and rested my elbows on the ledge, supporting my face in my hands. I thought of all that I had been told, thought of all the experiences that I had had, and my whole being welled with love for that great man. The Lama Minyadondup, my guide, who had shown me more love than my parents had ever shown me. I decided that no matter what the future would bring, I would always act and behave as if my guide were by my side supervising my actions. Down in the fields below, monk musicians were practicing their music. There were various brumps, brumps, brumps and squeaks and groans from their instruments. Idly I looked at them. Music meant nothing to me, for I was tone deaf, but I saw that they were very earnest men, trying hard indeed to produce good music. I turned away thinking that I would occupy myself once again with a book. Soon I tired of reading. I was unsettled. Experiences were tumbling upon me faster and faster. More and more idly I turned the pages, then with sudden resolution I put all those printed sheets back between the carved wooden covers and tied the tapes. This was a book which had to be wrapped in silk. With inborn care I completed my task and set aside the book. Rising to my feet, I went to the window and looked out. The night was somewhat stuffy, still, with not a breath of wind. I turned, and left the room. All was still, still with the quietness of a great building which was almost alive. Here in the Potala, men had worked at sacred tasks for some centuries, and the building itself had developed life of its own. I hurried along to the end of the corridor and scaled a ladder there. Soon I emerged onto the high roof, by the side of the sacred tombs. Silently I padded across to my accustomed spot, a spot which was well sheltered from the winds which normally raced down from the mountains. Lying back against a sacred image, with my hands clasped at the back of my head, I stared out across the valley. Tiring of that after a time, I lay back and looked up at the stars. As I watched, I had the strangest impression that all those worlds above were wheeling around the Potala. For a time it made me feel quite dizzy, as if I were falling. As I watched, there was a thin tracery of light. Becoming brighter, it exploded into a sudden burst of brilliant light. Another comet finished. I thought, as it burned itself out and expired into a shower of dull red sparks. I became aware of an almost inaudible shush-shush somewhere close by. Cautiously I raised my head, wondering what it could be. By the faint starlight I saw a hooded figure pacing backwards and forwards at the opposite side of the sacred tombs. I watched. The figure moved across to the wall facing the city of Lhasa. I saw the profile as he looked into the distance. The loneliest man in Tibet, I thought. The man with more cares and responsibilities than anyone else in the country. I heard a deep sigh and wondered if he too had hard prophecies such as I. Carefully I rolled over and crawled silently away. I had no desire to intrude, even innocently, upon the private thoughts of another. Soon I regained the entrance, and made my quiet way down to the sanctuary of my own room. Some 3 days later I was present as my guide, the Lama Minyadon Up examined the child of the Regyab couple. He undressed it and carefully viewed the aura. For some time he pondered upon the base of the brain. This baby did not cry or whimper, no matter what my guide did. As I knew, small as it was, it understood that the Lama Minyadon Up was trying to get it well. My guide at last stood up, and said, "Well, Lobsang. We are going to get him cured. It is clear that he has an affliction caused by birth difficulties." The parents were waiting in a room near the entrance. I, as close to my guide as his shadow, went with him to see those people. As we entered they prostrated themselves at the Lama's feet. Gently he spoke to them, "Your son can and will be cured. From our examination it is clear that at the time of birth he was dropped or knocked. That can be remedied, you need have no fear." The mother trembled as she replied, "Holy medical Lama, it is as you say." He came unexpectedly, suddenly, and was tumbled upon the floor. I was alone at the time. My guide nodded in sympathy and understanding, "Return at this hour tomorrow and I am sure you will be able to take your child with you, cured." They were still bowing and prostrating themselves as we left the room. My guide made me examine the baby carefully. "Look, Lobsang, there is pressure here," he instructed. "This bone is pressing upon the cord, you observe how the auric light becomes fan-shaped instead of round." He took my hands in his and made me feel round the affected area. "I am going to reduce, to press out, the obstructing bone. Watch." Faster than I could see, he pressed his thumbs in, out. The baby made no outcry, it had been too fast for him to have felt pain. Now, though, the head was not lolling sideways as before, but it was upright as a head should be. For some time my guide massaged the child's neck, carefully from the head down towards the heart, and never in the opposite direction. On the following day, at the appointed hour, the parents returned and were almost delirious with joy at seeing the seeming miracle. "You have to pay for this," smiled the Lama Minyadon Up, "you have received good. Therefore you must pay good to each other. Do not quarrel nor be at variance with each other, for a child absorbs the attitudes of the parents. The child of unkind parents becomes unkind. The child of unhappy, loveless parents is unhappy and loveless in its turn. Pay, by kindness and love to each other. We will call upon you to see the child in a week's time." He smiled, and patted the baby's cheek and then turned and went out, with me by his side. "Some of the very poor people are proud, Lobsang, they are upset if they have not money with which to pay. Always make it possible for them to think they are paying." My guide smiled as he remarked, "I told them they must pay." That pleased them, for they thought that, in their best dress, they had so impressed me that I thought they were people with money. The only way they can pay is, as I said, by kindness to each other. Let a man and woman keep their pride, their self-respect, Lobsang, and they will do anything you ask. Back in my own room I picked up the telescope with which I had been playing. Extending the shining brass tubes I peered in the direction of Lhasa. Two figures came quickly into focus, one carrying a baby. As I watched, the man put an arm around his wife's shoulder and kissed her. Silently I put away the telescope and got on with my studies. Chapter 11. We were having fun. Several of us were out in the courtyard strutting around on our stilts, attempting to topple each other over. The one who could remain on the stilts impervious to the assaults of the others was the winner. Three of us subsided in a laughing heap. Someone had put his stilts in a hole in the ground and bumped into us, tripping us. "Old teacher Rax was in a blue mood today, all right," said one of my companions, happily. "Yes," cried another of the heap, "it should make one of the others go green with envy that he could get in such a mood and take it out on us without getting out of breath." We all looked at each other and started to laugh, a blue mood, green with envy. We called the others to come off their stilts and sit on the ground with us, and then we started a new game. How many colors could we use in describing things?
Blue in the face, exclaimed one.
No, I answered, we have already had blue, we have already had a blue mood. So we went on, working up from a blue mood to an abbot who was in a brown study, and a teacher who was green with envy. Another referred to a scarlet woman he had seen in the marketplace in Lhasa. For the moment we did not know if that would apply because none of us was sure of what a scarlet woman was meant to be.
I know, retorted the boy to my right, we can have a man who is yellow, he is yellow with cowardice. After all, yellow is often used to indicate cowardice. I thought about all this, and it seemed to me that if such sayings were common usage in any language, then there must be some good underlying cause behind it, that set me off in search of my guide the Lama Minya dawned up.
Honorable Lama. I burst into his study in some excitement. He looked up at me not at all perturbed at my unceremonious entry.
Honorable Lama, why do we use colors to describe moods?
He put down the book which he was studying and motioned for me to be seated. I suppose you are meaning those common usage terms about a blue mood, or a man green with envy? He queried.
Yes, I answered in even more excitement that he should know precisely what I was referring to.
I really would like to know why all these colors are important. There must be something behind it.
He looked at me and laughed again, retorting, well, Lobsang, you have let yourself in for another nice long lecture. But I see that you have been doing some strenuous exercise and I think that you and I might have tea,
I was waiting for mine anyhow, before we go on with this subject.
Tea was not long in coming. This time it was tea and sampa, the same as any other monk or lama or boy in the whole of the Lamasery would be having. We ate in silence, I thinking about colors and wondering what the implication of colors would be. Soon we had finished our rather meager meal, and I looked at my guide expectantly.
You know a little about musical instruments, Lobsang, he commenced, you know, for example, that there is a musical instrument much used in the West known as a piano. You will remember that together we looked at a picture of one, it contains a keyboard with a lot of notes on it, some black and some white,
well, let us forget the black ones. Let us imagine instead that we have got a keyboard perhaps 2 miles long, longer if you like, it contains every vibration which can be obtained on any plane of existence.
He looked at me to see if I was following, because a piano was a strange device as far as I was concerned.
I, as my guide had said, had seen such a thing only in pictures.
Satisfied that I could perceive the underlying idea, he continued, if you had a keyboard containing every vibration, then the whole range of human vibrations would be in perhaps the three middle keys. You will understand, at least I hope you will, that everything consists of vibrations. Let us take the lowest vibration known to man. The lowest vibration is that of a hard material. You touch it and it obstructs the passage of your finger, at the same time all its molecules are vibrating. You can go further up the imaginary keyboard, and you can hear a vibration known as sound. You can go higher and your eyes can receive a vibration which is known as sight.
I jerked bolt upright at that, how could sight be a vibration? If I looked at a thing, well, how did I see?
You see, Lobsang, because the article which is being viewed vibrates and creates a commotion which is perceived by the eye. In other words, an article which you can see generates a wave which can be received by the rods and cones in the eye which in turn translates the impulses received to a portion of the brain which converts the impulses into a picture of the original article. It is all very complicated, and we do not want to go into it too thoroughly. I am merely trying to point out to you that everything is a vibration. If we go higher up the scale we have radio waves, telepathic waves, and the waves of those people who live on other planes. But, of course, I said that we are going to limit ourselves specifically to the mythical three notes on the keyboard which could be perceived by humans as a solid thing, as a sound, or as a sight. I had to think about all this, it was a matter which really made my brain buzz. I never minded learning, however,
by the kind methods of my guide. The only time I jibbed at learning was when some tyrannical teacher was whacking away at my poor old robe with a thoroughly unpleasant stick. You ask about colors, Lobsang. Well, certain vibrations are impressed upon one's aura as colors. Thus, by way of example, if a person is feeling miserable, if he is feeling thoroughly unhappy, then part of his senses will emit a vibration or frequency which approximates to the color which we call blue, so that even people who are not clairvoyant can almost perceive the blueness, and so that color has crept into most languages throughout the world as indicating a blue mood, an unpleasant, unhappy mood. I was beginning to get the drift of the idea now, but it still puzzled me how a person could be green with envy, and I said so. Lobsang, by deduction you should have been able to reason for yourself that when a person is suffering from the vice known as envy, his vibrations change somewhat so that he gives the impression to others of being green. I do not mean that his features turn green, as you are well aware, but he does give the impression of being green. I should also make it clear to you that when a person is born under a certain planetary influence, then he is affected more strongly by those colors. Yes. I burst out. I know that a person born under Aries likes red. My guide laughed at my eagerness and said, yes, that comes under the law of harmonics. Certain people respond more readily to a certain color because the vibration of that color is in close sympathy with their own basic vibration. That is why an Aries person, for example, prefers a red color, because the Aries person has much red in his makeup and he finds the color red itself pleasant to dwell upon. I was bursting to ask a question. I knew about these greens and blues. I could even make out why a person should be in a brown study, because when a person was concentrating on a particular form of study, his aura perhaps would be irrigated with brown flecks. But I could not understand why a woman should be scarlet. Honorable Lama, I burst out, unable to contain my curiosity any longer, why can a woman be called a scarlet woman? My guide looked at me as if he was going to burst, and I wondered for a moment what I had said which had caused him to nearly throw a fit with suppressed amusement. Then he told me, kindly and in some detail, so that in future I should not be so unclear on any subject. I want also to tell you, Lobsang, that every person has a basic frequency of vibration, that is, every person's molecules vibrate at a certain rate, and the wavelength generated by a person's brain can fall into special groups. No two persons have the same wavelength, not the same wavelength identical in every respect, but when two people are near the same wavelength, or when their wavelength follows certain octaves of the other, then they are said to be compatible and they usually get on very well together. I looked at him and wondered about some of our highly temperamental artists. Honorable Lama, is it true that some of the artists vibrate at a higher rate than others? I inquired. Most certainly it is, Lobsang, said my guide. If a man is to have what is known as inspiration, if he is to be a good artist, then his frequency of vibrations must be many times higher than normal. Sometimes it makes him irritable, difficult to get on with. Being of a higher rate of vibration than most of us, he tends to look down on us lesser mortals. However, often the work that he turns out is so good that we can put up with his slight fads and fancies. I imagined this great keyboard stretching for several miles, and it did seem to me a strange thing if, in a keyboard stretching several miles, the human range of experiences would be limited only to about 3 notes, and I said so. The human being, Lobsang, likes to think that he is the only thing in creation that is important, you know. Actually, there are many, many other forms of life besides humans. On other planets there are forms of life which are utterly alien to humans, and the average human could not even begin to understand such a form of life. On our mythical keyboard, the inhabitants of a planet far, far removed from this particular universe would be right away at a different end of the keyboard from that of the humans. Again, people on the astral planes of existence would be higher up the keyboard, for a ghost who can walk through a wall is of such a tenuous nature that his own rate of vibrations would be high indeed, although his molecular content would be low. He looked at me and laughed at my puzzled expression, and then explained, well, you see, a ghost can pass through a stone wall because a stone wall consists of molecules in vibration. There are spaces between every molecule, and if you can get a creature with molecules so small that they can fit between the spaces of a stone wall, then that particular creature would be able to walk through a stone wall with no obstruction whatever. Of course, the astral creatures have a very high rate of vibration, and they are of a tenuous nature, that is, they are not solid, which in its turn means that they have few molecules. Most people imagine that the space beyond our Earth, beyond the edge of the air above us, is empty. That is not so. Space has molecules throughout. They are mostly hydrogen molecules which are widely dispersed, but the molecules are there and they can indeed be measured in much the same way as can the presence of a so-called ghost be measured. The temple conches sounded, calling us once again to our services. We will talk about this again tomorrow, Lobsang, because I want you to be very clear on this subject, said my guide as we parted at the entrance to the temple. The ending of the temple service was the start of a race to get food. We were all rather hungry for our own food supplies were exhausted. This was the day when a new supply of freshly roasted barley was available. In Tibet all monks carry a small leather pouch of barley which has been roasted and ground and which, by the addition of buttered tea, becomes tsampa. So we raced on, and soon joined the throng waiting to have their bags filled. Then we went to the hall where tea was available so that we could have our evening meal. The stuff was terrible. I chewed at my tsampa and wondered if my stomach was wrong. There was a horrible, oily burnt taste to it, and I really did not know how I was going to get it down. "For," muttered the boy next to me, "this stuff has been burnt to a frazzle, none of us will be able to cram it down. It seems to me that everything has been spoiled in this lot of food," I said. I tried a bit more, screwing up my face in anxious concentration, wondering how I was going to cram it down. In Tibet to waste such food is a great offense. I looked about me, and saw that others were looking about them. The tsampa was bad, there was no doubt about that. Everywhere bowls are being put down and that was a very rare occurrence in our community where everyone was always just on the point of hunger. I hastily swallowed the tsampa in my mouth, and something very strange about it hit me with unexpected force in the stomach. Hastily scrambling to my feet, and apprehensively holding my mouth with my hand, I bolted for the door. "Well, young man," said a strangely accented voice as I turned back toward the door after having violently erupted the disturbing food. I turned and saw Kenji Tekuki, the Japanese monk who had been everywhere, seen everything, and done everything, and was now paying for it by way of periodic bouts of mental instability. He looked sympathetically at me. "Vile stuff, isn't it?" he remarked sympathetically. "I had the same difficulty as you and I came out here for the same reason. We shall have to see what happens. I am staying out for a few moments hoping that the fresh air will blow away some of the miasma which this bad food has caused." "Sir," I said diffidently, "you have been everywhere. And will you tell me why here in Tibet we have such dreadfully monotonous fare? I am sick to death of tsampa and tea, and tea and tsampa, and tsampa and tea. Sometimes I can hardly cram the muck down." The Japanese looked at me with great understanding and even greater sympathy. "Ah. So you ask me because I have tasted so many different kinds of food?" "Yes, and so I have. I have traveled extensively throughout the whole of my life. I have had food in England, Germany, Russia, almost everywhere that you can mention. Spite of my priestly vows I have lived well, or at least I thought so at the time, but now my dereliction from my vows has brought me to grief." He looked at me and then seemed to jerk to life again. "Oh. Yes. You ask why you have such monotonous fare. I will tell you. People in the West eat too much, and they have too great a variety of food. The digestive organs work on an involuntary basis, that is, they are not controlled by the voluntary part of the brain. As we teach, if the brain through the eyes has an opportunity of assessing the type of food which is going to be consumed, then the stomach can release the necessary quantity and concentration of gastric juices in order to deal with the food. If, on the other hand, everything is crammed down indiscriminately, and the consumer is busily engaged in idle talk all the time, then the juices are not prepared, digestion cannot be accomplished, and the poor wretch suffers from indigestion and later, perhaps, from gastric ulcers. You won't know why your food is plain? Well, the plainer and, within reason, the more monotonous the food one consumes, the better it is for the development of the psychic parts of the body. I was a great student of the occult, I had great powers of clairvoyance, and then I stuffed myself with all sorts of incredible concoctions and even more incredible drinks. I lost all my metaphysical powers, so that now I have come here to the Chakpura so that I may be attended, so that I may have a place where I can rest my weary body before leaving this earth. And when I have left this earth in just a few short months from now, the body breakers will do the job, will complete the task, which an indiscriminate admixture of drinks and food started. He looked at me and then gave one of those queer jumps again, and said, "Oh yes, my boy. You take my advice, you stick to plain food for all the days of your life and you will never lose your powers. Go against my advice and cram everything you can down your hungry gullet, and you will lose everything, and your gain? Well, my boy, you will gain indigestion, you will gain gastric ulcers together with a bad temper. Oh ho! I am going off, I can feel another attack coming." The Japanese monk, Kenji Takaki, rose shakily to his feet and tottered off in the direction of the Lama's quarters. I looked after him and shook my head sadly. I should very much have liked to have been able to talk to him much longer. What sort of foods were they? Did they taste good? Then I pulled myself up with a jerk. Why tantalize myself when all I had before me was rancid buttered tea and tsampa, which had been really burned so much that it was a charred mass, and in some way some strange oily compound had got into it. I shook my head and walked again into the hall. Later in the evening I was talking to my guide. The Lama Minya dawned up, by horoscopes from the peddlers down on the way. My guide smiled sadly as he replied, "Of course, as you know, there cannot be any worthwhile horoscope unless it is individually prepared for the person to whom it is alleged to refer. No horoscope can be prepared on a mass production basis. The horoscopes sold by the peddlers on the road below are merely so that they can get money from the credulous." He looked at me and said, "Of course, Lobsang, the pilgrims who have these horoscopes go back home and show they have a memento from the Potala. They are satisfied and so is the peddler, so why bother about them? Everyone is satisfied. Do you think people should have horoscopes prepared for them?" I asked. "Not really, Lobsang, not really. Only in certain cases such as your own case. Too often horoscopes are merely used to save a person the effort of adopting a course of action upon his own responsibility. I am very much against the use of astrology or horoscopes unless there is a definite, specific reason for it. As you know, the average person is like a pilgrim threading his way through the city of Lhasa. He cannot see the road ahead for the trees and the houses and the bends and curves in the road. He has to be prepared for whatever is coming. We here can look down upon the road and see any obstructions, for we are at a higher elevation. The pilgrim, then, is like a person with no horoscope. We being higher in the air than the pilgrim are like people with the horoscope, for we can see the road ahead, we can see obstacles and difficulties, and thus should be in a position to overcome difficulties before they really occur. There is another thing which is troubling me greatly, Honorable Lama. Can you tell me how it is that we know things in this life that we knew in the past?" I looked at him most anxiously, for I was always rather afraid of asking such questions, as really I had no right to be delving so deeply into matters, but he took no offense. Instead he replied, "Before we came to this earth, Lobsang, we mapped out what we intended to do. The knowledge was stored in our subconscious, and if we could get in touch with our subconscious, as some of us can, then we should know everything that we had planned. Of course, if we should know everything that we had planned, there would be no merit in striving to better ourselves, because we would know that we were working along a predetermined plan. For some reasons, sometimes a person will go to sleep or will get out of the body while conscious, and will get in touch with his overself. Sometimes the overself will be able to bring up knowledge from the subconscious and transfer it back to the body on earth, so that when the astral body returns to the flesh body, there is knowledge in the mind of certain things that happened in a past life. It may be as a special warning not to commit a mistake which may have been committed for life after life.